You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow, or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Introducing Bluehost Cloud, ultra-fast WordPress hosting with 100% uptime. Want a website with unmatched power, speed, and control? Of course you do. And now you can have all three with Bluehost Cloud, the new web hosting plan from Bluehost. With 100% uptime and incredibly speedy load times, your WordPress websites will be dependable and lightning fast on a global scale. Plus, your sites can handle even the biggest traffic spikes without going down or lagging. And with Bluehost Cloud, you get 24/7 WordPress priority support, meaning you're connected to WordPress experts anytime you need them. Not to mention, you automatically get daily backups and world-class security. So, what are you waiting for? Get Bluehost Cloud today by visiting Bluehost.com. That's Bluehost.com.
Good morning, Dr. History.
Good morning, Zeb. How you doing out there?
Well, just slip-sliding away.
That's why I decided not to drive out there today.
You know, I've had it. When are we going to hear a forecast, like I said a few minutes ago, of maybe sunny and 70, and boy, the good old days. Remember those?
Yeah, it's been a while.
It has.
It's been a while.
What's cooking in your world?
Well, I just want to say, make a comment. One of our listeners, he's called in a number, or sent me messages a few times, Joe Smith. He listened to our Bonnie and Clyde episode, and he actually sent me a map that shows that Bonnie and Clyde actually ranged clear from Minnesota clear down to Houston. And I didn't realize they covered that big of a territory in their crime sprees that they were on.
Well, I wasn't sure about the Minnesota or the Upper Great Lakes region, but I definitely knew that they were all the way down into Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize. I figured they were down that far, but not that high, far north, clear up to the Minnesota Great Lakes area. So, anyway, thanks, Joe, for the information. So, today's Zeb is going to be part three of our Trappers and Trailblazers, and so this is probably the last one I do on this for a while, but I want to talk a little bit about Jim Beckworth.
I know who you mean.
Yeah, you've heard of him. I know we've mentioned him. So he was born around 1800 into slavery. His father was a Virginia aristocrat, and his mother was a mixed-blood slave. So basically, he was an African-American. At the age of 10, they moved to St. Louis. He only had 4 years of education, but he was a pretty smart guy. He had an aptitude for languages, and he became fluent in English and French, and could also understand Spanish. So he was quite an intelligent guy.
Mm-hmm.
But Beckworth's father set him up with a blacksmith apprentice, but, you know, that really wasn't going to work out for him. He answered the call of William Ashley in 1822 to become part of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company.
You know, let me ask you a question right there. For many of these people like Beckworth and others that maybe had never done this before, never been a trapper or an explorer, who put all the money up and what was the enticement?
Well, I think the enticement was, number one, I think was adventure and money, and whoever put it up would be the leader. For example, with Ashley, William Ashley, it was his company, the Rocky Mountain Fur Company.
Mm-hmm.
So they put up the money and whatever they needed to get those men out to the West. But so Beckworth actually was a key part of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company back in 1824, 25. They went, you know, they did very well. Beckworth actually claimed that he and his son, evidently as he got older, he had a son with him, that they actually got in a fight with some Crow Indians, which is ironic because eventually he became part of the Crow tribe.
Hmm.
But another incident, Beckworth was guarding a man who had been mauled by a grizzly bear along the trail when the bear came back to attack, Beckworth, along with William Ashley, brought this big old grizzly down with a couple of well-placed shots. But that year, it was very successful. They brought back $50,000 in furs,
which
of course, would have been worth millions, but in today's terms.
Mm-hmm.
So over the next few years, Beckworth spent time, as I said, among the Crow tribe. He became fluent in their language. He participated in war parties, usually against the rival Blackfeet, and he was even deemed an honorary chief. Anyway, he was quite an amazing man. But, like I say, he became a war chief of the Crow tribe. He boasted forever that of the honors he won in battle with his adopted people. And once, according to his own account, when he engaged in lone combat with a number of enemy warriors, probably Blackfeet, he was reinforced by a party of the Crows. But here's what he said, quote, "I despoiled my victim of his gun, lance, war club, bow, and quiver of arrows. Now I was the greatest man in the party, for I had killed the first warrior. We painted our faces black and rode back to the village bearing 11 scalps."
You know, as far as the weaponry back in those days, how dependable was it, those old flintlock rifles, et cetera?
Well, you've heard of the old saying, a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or if the powder gets wet, yeah, they weren't always totally 100% successful. But, you know, Beckworth goes on. He says, quote, "I fought in their behalf against the most relentless enemies of the white man. If I chose to become an Indian while living among them, it concerned no person but myself, and by doing so, I saved more life and property for the white man than a whole regiment of United States regulars could have done at the time."
Hmm.
So he thought fairly highly of himself, I would say. But, you know, mountain men, they sometimes talk a little big, and a lot of times they lived that way, too. They were a big presence.
Well, did he keep a diary, or did he keep some kind of a journal or whatever?
You know, a lot of them did, and I don't what I'm looking at here looks like more quotes from, could have been a journal of some kind, or letters, or something. But as I mentioned, you know, the mountain men, they were distinct, you know. In fact, a lot of contemporary descriptions of them were, you know, they're kind of romanticized, or they're not really accurate. But there's an account given by of a typical mountain man, contributed by a guy by the name of Rufus Sage, okay? And he himself was a mountain trapper during the 1830s. And I'm just going to read how he describes it, okay? So this is according to Rufus Sage, whom I've never heard of. It says, "His skin, from constant exposure, assumes a hue almost as dark as that of the Aborigine, and his features and physical structure attain a rough and hardy cast. His hair, through inattention, becomes long, coarse, and bushy, mm-hmm. and loosely dangles upon his shoulders. His head is surmounted by a low-crowned wool hat or a rude substitute of his own manufacture. His clothes are of buckskin, gaily fringed at the seams with strings of the same material, cut and made in fashion peculiar to himself and associates. The deer and buffalo furnish him the required covering for his feet, which he fabricates at the impulse of want. His waist is encircled with a belt of leather, holding encased his butcher knife and pistols, while from his neck is suspended a bullet pouch securely fastened to the belt in front, and beneath the right arm hangs a powder horn traversely from his shoulder, behind which, upon the strap attached to it, are affixed his bullet, molded, ball, screw, wiper, and all, with a gun stick, which is a homemade ramrod, made of some hardwood, and a good rifle placed in his hands, carrying from 35 balls to the pound. The reader will have before him a correct likeness of a genuine mountaineer when fully equipped."
Holy smokes. I mean, when they get up and get dressed in the morning, it must have taken 3 hours.
Well, I don't know that they took much off when they went to bed. You know, you had to be able to be up and moving in a hurry, I think. And that's according to this guy named Rufus Sage. Now, he goes on, and I wish I knew more about this guy. I need to find out a little more about him. But, you know, he says that for an entire winter, they dressed pretty much like John Coulter had, and he usually carried several knives, a pipe, tobacco, and perhaps some reading material for the winter. And he suggested a lot of times they had a Bible, a book by Shakespeare, books of poetry. And so they, and I mentioned this before, they were, most of them were well-read. There's only about 13% that were illiterate. So, and a lot of them did keep journals. So, but they carried spare locks and flints, 25 pounds of powder, 100 pounds of lead. You know, they usually had 40 to 60 caliber rifles. And usually they wanted the Hawken brothers of St. Louis. They liked the Hawken rifle.
Right.
Because it was said to be accurate at up to 200 yards, and it was powerful enough to knock down a buffalo or a grizzly bear or, you know, whatever.
You know, so, one of the questions I would have as you're going through the litany of things that they took with them, you mentioned the Bible. And I found it interesting because a lot of the Bibles, or most of the Bibles at that day and age, weren't they the big, cumbersome Bibles? Or did they find somebody to print a smaller version?
You know, that's a good question. And I, you know, you hear of the stories or see people that have a family Bible that weighs 20 pounds.
Yeah. Yep.
And I'm thinking, no, I tried to picture this in my mind. They had to have had smaller Bibles, small enough to fit in a, you know, in their packs or whatever. So, but, you know, except for a little flour or coffee, tea, and salt, the mountain men, they didn't carry any food. They lived exclusively off the land. They might gather some wild plums and nuts. Sometimes they'd just eat whatever they had. If they were getting hungry, they might eat roots or even bark, or
so
they might even.
If you saw a real skinny man in the wilderness, you knew he was a very poor shot.
He was a very poor shot. Yes, and more than likely, he was headed to some place where civilization was. But anyway, you know, when they were cooking, though, they'd throw in the buffalo in the pot. They'd throw in buffalo or deer or elk, antelope. Even a bobcat, a rabbit, a wolf, even a hawk would do. Now, unfortunately, because of their diet of fat meat, they quite often had a form of dysentery that was kind of a frequent and could be a fatal complaint among the mountain men. So, you know, they weren't getting fruits and vegetables, you know, when they were out there in the wintertime, just meat.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But next to his guns, the most important possession the mountain man had were 4 to 6 beaver traps, and they usually cost about $12 to $16 a piece, and they were put to work during the two trapping seasons. Now, the first was in the fall after the summer fur had become prime, and it lasted until the ice and the snow made travel and trapping impossible. And the second time began in the spring when the ice began to break up and continued until the quality of the fur deteriorated because of the warm weather. But at both seasons, the water in which the trapper worked was freezing cold water.
Oh, yeah.
And one thing you never think about, or probably most people don't, is rheumatism brought on by this being in this cold water. And that was a pretty common occupational ailment.
So. You know, and the thing that really scares me about thinking about being a mountain man and taking off, if you're by yourself or even with another guy, is if you broke that gun, if you broke that Hawken, and you're without any defense or any protection, and you're, what, thousands of miles away from getting a replacement? Woo!
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, like I said, they're in this ice-cold water. What if you fall down and you go completely under, you get out, and all of a sudden the storm hits? You know, I think a lot of them knew how to start a fire fairly quickly, but still, you know, if the temperature dropped rather quickly, you might be done.
Yeah,
frozen,
absolutely.
You know? But the trapping procedure was, you know, they would wade into this pond or swamp, so they'd set a trap, and they'd put it under the water. And when the animal was trapped, it would hold them underwater and they would drown. Now, some of the beaver actually would gnaw off their foot, to escape. But the trap was usually, maybe some kind of a scent or a piece of greenery, but, they'd check their traps every few days. And can you imagine hauling a 40-pound beaver out of the mud and the cold water, day after day. I mean, these were big, big animals, 40 pounds.
What was the worth? What was the net worth when they traded those pelts? What did they get on a per beaver basis? Do you know?
You know, I'm looking through here, and I cannot remember. But I believe, as I recall, it's so much per pound.
I see.
That they got, and I might find it here as we're going along. But anyway, you know, a lot of times during the winter time, they'd have to settle in and just have a crude camp. Now, this Rufus Sage, again, I need to find out this guy. Here's what he said during the winter time when they weren't trapping. He said, quote, "It is usually located in some spot sheltered by hills or rocks for the double purpose of securing the full warmth of the sun's rays and screening it from the notice of strolling Indians that may happen in its vicinity. Within a convenient proximity to its stands, some grove from which an abundance of dry fuel is procurable when needed, and equally close to the ripplings of a watercourse salute the ear with their music." Don't you like the language there, Zeb?
You know, and some of these old books, and like you're talking about, and even some of the older movies, they depicted some of that colorful language, because that's really how those people talked back in those days.
It was. You know, he goes on, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he talks about his shanty faces a huge fire. He had beaver pelts that he had to dress out, and he had a framework, and he'd stretch the frames, the skins over the frames, and they'd use a stone or a scraper, and some of it they made their own clothing that they maybe weren't going to, you know, take to sell.
Yeah.
But a lot of times they would actually have an Indian girl in camp to perform some of the camp chores, and a lot of the times the tribesmen would actually sell an Indian girl to at the rendezvous, and the price might be as little as a jug of whiskey or a horse, but one mountain man claimed to have paid $2,000 in beaver skins for a chief's daughter.
Wow.
And as I've mentioned before, there was a number of times when these Indian women would actually follow their husbands into like St. Louis and different places and became very wealthy in some of these towns.
How were they accepted, though?
Not very well. One guy named George Catlin, he described, he said, quote, "Their women are beautiful and modest, and if either Indian or white man wishes to marry the most beautiful girl in the tribe, she is valued only equal, perhaps, to two horses, a gun with powder, and a ball for years." You know, even then, you know, out in the wintertime, you know, it can be rough out there. But, you know, some men achieved a hero status for their exploits, like Bill Sublett. He worked from being an ordinary trapper to a partner in the Rocky Mountain Fur Company, and he became a wealthy man, very wealthy. Kit Carson later, of course, made his name in the West as a freelance Indian fighter, and the only brigadier general in the United States Army who could write nothing beyond his own name and could read nothing at all.
Well, what about Bill Sublett, though? Go back to him. Is he the same Sublett that our area of Sublett was named after?
Uh-huh. Yeah, William or Bill Sublett and his brother. Oh, gosh, I can't remember his brother's name. They were both with the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. Started out with Ashley. But, you know, there were some kind of what we call misfits among them. There was a guy whose family sent him west to spare themselves the embarrassment of his, quote, drunkenness and recklessness, and which that didn't work out. There was a Cherokee guy named Edward Rose, and he was one of Ashley's original crew. He turned up in a Crow village. He enjoyed the rank of chief. And then there was a guy named Old Bill Williams. He was a religious fanatic who lived by choice completely alone in the wilderness, and he only came out from time to time with what they called fabulous loads of prime furs from secret trapping grounds. You know, they had a secret place. They didn't just go tell everybody about it.
Yeah.
But Williams kind of gained a bad reputation among the mountain men. He was believed to have maybe even practiced cannibalism.
Oh, boy.
But we don't know that. But there was actually, you know, when you think about going in there with nothing, there was actually a manual. It was called The Trapper's Guide, a manual of instructions, and it says, for capturing all kinds of fur-bearing animals and curing their skins with observations on the fur trade, hints on life in the woods, and relatives of trapping and hunting excursions. That's the title of this Trapper's Guide.
I like those real concise titles.
Yes. Oh, boy. But, you know, even with, you know, I mean, it was a lethal occupation. I mean, they died of drowning, injuries, dysentery, smallpox, tetanus, occasional gunshot wounds. They fell off mountains. They were bitten by rattlesnakes, mauled by grizzly bears like old Hugh Glass.
Yeah.
It was a dangerous occupation.
And, you know, there's one thing, and we've only got a couple of minutes left here, but I want to throw this at you. What would you think would be the number one thing that possibly you, but I know I'd be concerned about, and that's having a bad tooth?
You know, I hadn't thought of that, but, oh, boy, that could be a miserable situation. And you know, if it abscessed or one thing or another, you could get infection and die from it. You know, but it was a fairly lucrative occupation. I mean, they could make some good money, but then again, when they went to the, trappers sold beaver pelts at rendezvous for $2 to $4 a pound, and they would later be sold in St. Louis for $6 to $8.
Wow. That, according to the inflationary figure of today, that's a lot of money.
It is. It is. And, you know, they would go to rendezvous and get this money, and unfortunately, by the time the rendezvous was over, a lot of times they didn't have any money left. They had enough to re-outfit for the next winter, and that was about it.
I can just imagine you 175 years ago putting on your buckskins and a coonskin cap and hitting the South Hills.
On my snowmobile? Maybe.
Oh, I'm out of time, but I really enjoyed that. You know, we ought to do another series on these mountain men as far as what they ate and how they took care of medical emergencies and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. This is part three of our series on the trappers and the trailblazers. And so maybe down the road ways, we'll do another series on them.
All right. Well, I hope the roads are better next week, and I certainly appreciate it.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.